Hey listeners, we're in the heat of one of the greatest sports events of the year. You guessed it, March Madness. And the best place to stay on top of all the NCAA tournament coverage? CBS Sports HQ. What is CBS Sports HQ? It is the free 24-hour sports network that's built for fans just like you. From nonstop highlights to news and analysis, CBS Sports HQ has got you covered. Check out CBS Sports HQ. It is always on and always free. No need to pay a subscription fee or have an expensive cable package. Download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Fire TV, Roku, or Apple TV to start watching today.
This is Amazing Avenue in Conversation, a podcast where we invite interesting people to talk about themselves, the Mets, and more. My name is Brian Salvatore, and my guest for this inaugural episode is Ron Darling. Ron needs no introduction, though I'll give him one in just a minute anyway. But before we begin, I want to note that this interview took place on Monday, April 1st, and so was recorded before the back and forth between Ron and Lenny Dykstra over a story in Ron's new book, 108 Stitches, took place. We do discuss that story and lots more in our chat. And so without further ado, here's Ron Darling. All right, I am joined on the show today by Ron Darling, the author of 108 Stitches, but not just that, the voice of the New York Mets, an 86 Met championship player, a beloved part of the Mets franchise. Thank you for being here, Ron. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. So I read the book in about 2 days. I flew through it. I really enjoyed the book for a lot of reasons. But I think the number one thing I enjoyed about the book was just how honest it was. You know, I've read a lot of ballplayers' memoirs, and sometimes they're full of fluff, and there's no sort of self-reflection. There's no controversial opinions in it. And I felt your book was very honest. So when you were putting this together, how important to you was it to make it a more honest portrayal of your time in baseball?
Well, that's interesting. I think as you get older, right, you become more honest with the distance between you and when you did things. And, you know, the nature of the book, 108 Stitches, was, you know, there's 108 stitches in a baseball. I wanted that interconnectivity with the stories and the personalities so that at the end you would have a fully formed baseball, just what the stitches do to a baseball. But also I thought for good luck, 108 is always a good number played on a team that 108 games. And I think, you know, I think what I was trying to do in the game, and I probably had 200 stories. So the most important was to get the ones that connected. So that eliminated stories right away. But also I think, I don't know, as I've gotten older, and this is my third book, I think my books have become more honest and honest in the sense that things I've heard and seen, things I've done in my past, warts and all, that I would love to take back. And, you know, I don't know if it's cathartic for everyone, but it's cathartic for me. And you know, baseball is a very complicated and beautiful sport in that it's 8 months a year if you include spring training, and a lot can happen because there's a lot of downtime. How you spend that downtime is lends itself to how self-aware you are, and you know, I feel as though I could have been more.
One of the parts of the book that I think is going to get a lot of attention, and I don't want to talk about the big number, the big sort of moment, which is you talk about an interaction with Oil Can Boyd and Lenny Dykstra, and you talk about how you stood up by the sidelines while Lenny was being, let's say, not kind to Oil Can. And, you know, racism has a long history in baseball. And I think today we're seeing a different sort of bias in baseball, which is, you know, you'll watch a player play, and if it's a white player, you'll often hear that the player has heart and has spunk. But if a Latin player does a similar thing, you'll see they're playing the game the wrong way sometimes, you know, or they're not showing enough respect. So how do you think that the sort of the tenor of acceptance and the tenor of racism has changed since you stopped playing?
Yeah, well, there's still, I think you, one, thank you. That's a very intelligent question. Two, I think, you know, this certain, certainly latent racism with regard to every kind of player that plays. What I was trying to write about as I stood on the sidelines is that, you know, I wrote this in the heat of Colin Kaepernick and deciding to be on the right side of history and not the wrong side of history. Baseball players tend to have this fraternity of anything goes and, you know, whatever you do is in the spirit of trying to win the ball game. And I just think that I'm embarrassed by my complicitness as I look back on my life. I don't know if I could have changed it any different because I, you know, I can't be disingenuous. As soon as Lenny hit that home run, most important hit we had in that World Series, I was as happy as anyone else. But I guess I'm just ashamed, I guess, and embarrassed that that I did not, I was not braver and on the better side of history. And I hope moving forward, it's a lesson for me to be on that right side.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to watch baseball from a perspective of, I mean, I've been watching baseball for over 30 years. You know, it's yeah, an important part of my life. But you sort of start to see how the game isn't just changing on the field, but is changing off the field. And I would hope that if that happened today, the incident that, you know, you described with Lenny Dykstra, I would hope that players today would be more willing to step up and say something because just the world is a better place in terms of that, you know. But do you, but you're around the game more than I am. Do you think the reaction will be the same if that happened today?
I don't think it would happen today. I think the players are much more sophisticated, braver, smarter than our players. I think they're more aware. I think just playing with black athletes and a higher percentage of Latin American athletes, they certainly have to be more inclusive or they're just not going to be able to play in today's game. There's always outliers on both sides that are going to exist in every part of the world and in every part of any kind of profession. But I think, no, I don't think it would happen today. I don't think that would be a rallying cry for anyone or any profession. Like I said, I wrote this in the heat of Colin Kaepernick, who I really admire. And admire what he's chosen to do. And, you know, politically that puts me in a sensitive place. But I think that, you know, I had my moment to act many times, I'm sure, in my life, to act right, on the side of right, or on the side of indifference. And, right is going to be moving forward from the last few years, many years, and difference makes me ashamed.
Well, you know, I certainly respect the shame that you feel. You know, we've all done things we've been ashamed of, but I think it's really great that you're speaking out about it. So bravo for that. I really appreciate that in the book. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between playing today versus playing when you were coming up. You know, when I was reading your book, you know, the chapter about coming up to the Mets and just, you know, throughout the system having people who were not giving the rookies the time of day, whether it's your manager in AAA or your manager in the big leagues or players that, you know, spit tobacco on your nice clean jersey, things like that. You know, there was a lot of sort of toughening up of rookies that happened then. For, I guess it's a two-part question. The first thing is, do you think that helped you in any way, or was that just purely, you know, a boys' club that was out of control? And then secondly, do you think that those type of things are still happening today, or has that also softened with time?
Well, answer your latter question. Yeah, certainly it would not be tolerated today. If you're on the team, you're 125th of the team. Are there different rules for different stars? Certainly, the 25th person on the team probably is not going to be looked at the same way as a as a star second baseman is. That will always be the case because that's the nature of sports. It's good and bad. I think that, in my day, there was not a bullying is too strong of a word, but there was a old boy network that you had to pass through that gauntlet or scrum to prove yourself worthy. And if you didn't do that, it was very difficult. I think the thing I found very hard was, you're either in or you're out. And I chose to be in as opposed to out. And that's a very difficult thing to do. I wish that, more outside thinkers, free spirits, whatever. We're seeing the same thing with Trevor Bauer, right? Mm-hmm. Trevor Bauer thinks a lot differently than, your average ball player. So there's no gray area. People either really like Trevor Bauer or dislike him. I think he's incredibly brave to be out on an island like he is. I was not brave enough. I just kind of bought into, while I'm at the ballpark, I'm going to be a ball player kind of thing. But the way I think it works both ways is that occasionally what will happen now when everyone's 125th of the team is that I think players at some point, things are so good for how they do things is that they don't always kind of appreciate the people that are doing it right now at a high level for a long period of time. And you are always known to make sure you understood that, is that the reason you're not up where he is because for the last 10 years he's won 15 games and completed 100 or whatever. So there was a much more interest in the history of the game. And I think the players today really are much more interested in how they take care of themselves, the process of getting ready for a game, and that is enough. Getting ready, being prepared, doing the process, and then hopefully it'll show results in the game.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way to look at sort of playing then versus playing now. One of the things that I just loved about the book is as I'm reading this, every page I'm turning, I just feel your passion for the game and how much you love baseball coming off of the page. And so how has that love of baseball changed from going on the field to in the broadcast booth? Do the same things get you excited today? Or is it a different sport almost watching it from, the broadcast booth versus watching it from the dugout?
Well, different things get me excited today. The one thing, two things that most people miss about baseball is competition. And second, the bantering back and forth between players. That's a lot of fun. Well, I get the bantering with Keith and Gary in the booth. So that is taken care of. So certainly the competition that I missed so dearly, I don't think about as much anymore. I think about the game and hopefully a more cerebral way. Not only how do players think, how do they get prepared, what they were thinking in really good plays, what they were thinking when they made mistakes, and managers. I do a lot more managing now with managers because a couple of reasons. One, there was a day when managers were just off limits because they had so much experience and so smart, and it was their way or the highway kind of thing. And I think with managers today with less experience and also with the analytics involved, you're seeing a lot of moves that are some conventional, some unconventional, and I'm trying to figure out when unconventional is supposed to be used or conventional is supposed to be used. And it's an interesting, fun puzzle to try to get through.
Get your brackets ready. March Madness is here, and the best place to stay on top of all the NCAA tournament coverage? CBS Sports HQ. CBS Sports HQ is a free 24-hour sports network that's built for fans just like you. From nonstop highlights to news and analysis, CBS Sports HQ has got you covered by cutting through the noise of hot takes and fake debates to get smart analysis and helpful highlights for your fantasy teams and beyond. Check out CBS Sports HQ. It's always on and always free. No need to pay a subscription fee or have an expensive cable package. Download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Fire TV, Roku, or Apple TV to start watching today.
Hello, I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seemed Smart. It Seems Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seem smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain. Or, I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission. Or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.
Yeah. One of the things that I just adored in the book is there are all these chapters that are sort of name association, right? You tell a story about a player that you played with, that you played against, that, you know, someone that managed you. So if you don't mind, I have a couple of people that you broadcast about. I wanted to sort of just pick your brain about some of these players that you've, you know, had experience with. The first one is, you know, the most significant Met of the last 25 years or so, and that's David Wright. What do you think of David Wright? Give us a good David Wright story.
Well, you know, I think all the stories that people tell about him are stuff I certainly don't have to say. You know, as good a person as I've ever seen that ever wore a uniform, as good a representative of his ball club when he played. As far as David as a person, I just find him to be a lot funnier than people will notice. I've said a couple of things on the air that he's brought to my attention that we've both had a real big laugh about. I think he has an unbelievable love for the game, and I think that's one of the reasons why it was so difficult for him to go through what he did at the end of his career. And then the most important thing, because you're only judged as a ball player kind of off your baseball card, and for a long stretch of time, he was an elite player. And I think that, you know, for guys like Don Mattingly or to a lesser degree, Keith Hernandez, you know, people that have had amazing stretches of career but have not been able to finish it on their terms is a shame, not only for them, but all of us who love the game.
Absolutely. What about Johan Santana?
Royalty. I felt like he was the royal prince or king or mayor or something of Venezuela whenever I met him. There just was a regalness around not only what he was off the field, but certainly how he took the field and his poise and body language on the mound are something that I wish I had played with him to try to copy. Dwight, you know, lucky enough to play with the great Dwight Gooden, and he has just a youthful exuberance and beauty to the way he threw the baseball. With Johan, I felt it was though, you know, I'm going to dictate the at-bats. I'm going to dictate this game, and you can try to compete against me, but like most others, you will come up short. I mean, that's kind of how I saw him on the field. And I'm just I'm so happy. And I've never done this to any pitcher, but after he pitched his no-hitter, I went downstairs and gave him a hug. And that was out of character for me, probably for him also. But I did want to give him a hug because of all the pitchers that have pitched in a Mets uniform, there's a lot of good ones, right? And I think it was important, at least it was important to me. I shouldn't speak for anyone else. It was important for me to have royalty like Santana be the first one. I think it was important to the anyone that has pitched at a high level for the Mets.
I want to ask about one of Johan's teammates, who's one of my favorite Mets of all time, and that's R.A. Dickey.
Well, R.A. Dickey is so much more than a pitcher. You know, I mean, he's so much more than a Cy Young Award winner. He's so much more than a number one pick. You know, he's transformative as a human being. He took his position for a short time on a national stage and changed the discussion for some children all over the world. And, you know, that to me is much more important than anything he did on the field. And he did some amazing things on the field, and what he did in the Cy Young Award year was a beautiful thing to watch from the booth every fifth day. But, you know, how many athletes transformed the lives of others? Not many. Ari Dickey, I'll remember him for that.
All right. Last one for this little round here, and that's Bartolo Colon.
Well, but Bartolo Colon, he is Shakespeare. He's Falstaff. So many things all put into one. And I hope it doesn't over cloud his abilities as a pitcher. You know, he had things happen in his life, as we discussed mine, that I'm sure that he'd like to erase. And but you can't erase the ability to get people out at such an advanced age. And in a day and age where every person I've ever seen get people out, as they get older, invent pitches as they go, to a point where they've got 4, 5, 6 pitches. Bartolo's the only person I've ever seen that went to one pitch and just mastered that. Yes, did he mix in a couple changeups? Yes, did he throw occasional slider? All of those are true. But I've never seen anyone be able to master the way a ball thinks and moves in the strike zone like he could with simple finger pressure. Almost like his hands were as valuable as any great pianist. Of course, you'll remember the home run, and that was one of the great. And Gary said it. Gary Cohn said it's one of the great memories in Mets history. It will. It'll be sure. But I think I'll always remember is that when he really needed it, he could throw 93 miles an hour. And we marvel at Noah Syndergaard, who is in his prime, who can throw 99 miles an hour. So that means that 20 years from now, Noah would only have to lose 6 miles an hour on his fastball to be able to match the great Colon.
Wow.
That's a sobering way to look at it.
It is. Just a couple of quick fun ones to end our chat here today, because I know you're a very, very busy man. You've said that you think Noah Syndergaard is going to win the Cy Young this year. What is it about him this spring that you saw that you think this is the year for Noah?
It really wasn't the spring. I thought I saw it in spring training. I saw it at the end of last year. You know, going twice, and I know it's hard to judge September, but pitching 9 innings twice, pitching his first shutout on the last game of the season, should be a blueprint to him about how good he can be. And I also think it's a perfect storm. I think he's a year better, a year more experience. He pitched on the same team that had the Cy Young Award winner, so he sees excellence every fifth night. I just think he's really in a good spot. I think in 86, I might have finished fifth in the Cy Young Award voting, and that would be the highest I ever finished. But I felt like I had that perfect storm then. Dwight was coming off a Cy Young Award win. I was at the best I was ever going to be because, you know, my physical gifts matched my intellectual gifts about getting people out. And I knew that was going to be my best shot to have a great year. Mine ended up fifth. He certainly has elite talent. And I think that, you know, this is the year he puts himself in elite status.
How do you feel about the proposed three-batter minimum rule coming into effect next year?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of it because, like the other rules, whether it was the Buster Posey rule or the Ruben Tejada rule, let's call it that. Chase, I don't want to call it Chase something rule. I'll call it Ruben Tejada rule. When we legislate these new things into the game, we don't know the collateral damage or effect that it'll have. And, you know, there are many times in the game where one batter, one pitcher is the way to go. I don't think it'll quicken the game as much as they think. Second, and I think this is more important, you might put some pitchers in harm's way because there are many pitchers on a given night in the bullpen that the manager will come out and say to him, hey, can you give me one batter tonight? And they, yeah, you know, so they'll tough it out to get one out for your team of the 27 that you need to get a victory. And I think that's really important. And the third thing is that, and I don't know, you can't legislate this. You can only hope that teams think more in this way. I think there's enough thought about injuries in this game that I don't think that any team is doing a job on preventing pitchers' injuries that is revolutionary and that will change the game. So let's assume we're going to continue to have injuries, whether the starting pitchers throw 165 innings or they throw 200 innings. The only way to change time of game and pace of game, but more importantly, time of game, if you have interest in that, is that there were 41 complete game starts. There were more last year, but a couple were rainouts. 41 nine-inning complete game starts. The average time of game in those games was 2 hours and 88 minutes. So, I can understand trying to limit how many relievers you use. I think it's going to put relievers in harm's way. But let's take these big, fine athletes that you pay a lot of money to. Maybe give them a bigger contract earlier in their career so the risk of injury still allows them to have made a good living in the game. And let's pitch them. Let's pitch them and pitch them hard between 23 and 30. And if we did that, you would quicken up the game.
All right, last question for you, Ron. There's only one question when I read your book that you didn't answer, and I need an answer for this. And that is, you mentioned you know where the best slice in New York City is. Where is the best slice? We need to know.
Well, the best slice that I ever had when I was a kid, just growing up playing in New York City, is a place called the Suttons that I used to go to in Chelsea in the day. So that's where I got the best slice. DeFars, of course, is a place I'll go to, but the best slice in the country, I will tell you, is a place in Hot Springs, Arkansas, of all places, called DeLuca's, and it's owned by a man named Anthony Valinotti from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. I've been there only once before in my life, and it changed my mind, one, about what pizza tastes like, and two, changed my mind that the only place you can get a good slice is in New York.
I don't know if you can hear that, but that's the sound of everybody trying to book a trip to Arkansas to get a slice of pizza right now.
Hey, listen, I've been there. It's tough to get there, so good luck.
Ron, where can folks find you on the internet? I know you're a recent Twitter adoptee, so where do you want people to check you out?
Yeah, I'm at Ron Darling Jr. R, the D, and the J are capitalized. That's my Twitter account. I'm not on it today, certainly, or even this week, certainly, because I have people tweeting in my favor to let everyone know where I'm at. But like you said, I'm literally doing one thing after another for the next 3 or 4 days. But you can find me there. And occasionally I have a run where I love interacting with the fans, and that's fun. And as far as anything else, the Gary, Keith, and Ron Instagram account seems to still be working as far as being funny, and we're trying to make it funny. And so you can find us in our silly antics there.
Well, thank you for all you do for the game. Thank you as a Mets fan for the great commentary, the great memories. And 108 Stitches is available right now. Go pick it up. Thank you so much, Ron Darling.
Thank you very much for a great interview.
Well, folks, thank you for joining us on this inaugural edition of Amazing Avenue in Conversation. This is one of 5 new podcasts we have from Amazing Avenue. So please go to AmazingAvenue.com, check out all those new podcasts, and stay tuned for future installments of Amazing Avenue in Conversation Fridays at AmazingAvenue.com. So until next time, let's go Mets.
It's me, Ashley Carmen.
And I'm Caitlin Tiffany.
And we are the hosts of the Verge's podcast, Why'd You Push That Button?
It's a show that asks the hard, weird, occasionally dumb questions about how your tiny tech decisions impact your social life.
So we're asking questions like, how do you choose your skin tone emoji? And why do you delete your tweets?
Every episode, we talk to both users and experts to get to the bottom of these questions that we're confronted with every day.
Check it out. Subscribe to Why'd You Push That Button on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or anywhere else you love to get podcasts.
My name is Spencer Hall.
My name is Jason Kirk.
My name is Ryan Nanny.
And when we combine, we form
the Shutdown Fullcast.
I keep telling you, we're not Voltron.
The Shutdown Fullcast is technically a college football podcast, but it's also a show about
lawn care disasters,
regional grocery stores we love,
Tennessee Batman,
homeowners associations,
Bears and video games,
Pittsburgh Batman,
the hell of being trapped in a group text,
unreliable legal advice.
I mean, there's also some actual football discussion, like about coaches having huge contracts, or coaches making terrible decisions, or coaches saying really stupid things.
Or the NCAA saying really stupid things.
Yeah, there's lots of stupid things in this big, dumb, beautiful sport.
Like the time Arkansas decided to use a captured feral hog as a mascot, and it escaped and it wound up killing 7 rattlesnakes, a pig, and a coyote.
Sometimes we talk about football games.
Allegedly.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it deserves to be taken, come find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts like this one.
The Shutdown Fullcast.
It's not Voltron.
Unless it is.
Damn it.